They said justice was finally served. But I was there for every trial, every contradiction, every carefully crafted lie. My name is Claire Merritt, and I've spent over 20 years covering one of the most chilling cases in American history, the 2002 murders of Mike Sisko and Karen Harkness. Everyone thought Dana Chandler was the answer. But after three trials, overturned verdicts, suppressed evidence, and political pressure, I began to wonder, was she truly a killer, or just the perfect villain for a system desperate for closure? This is more than a true crime story. It's a descent into obsession, manipulation, and the quiet rot beneath our justice system. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Never thought the sound of a piano could haunt me. Not a song, not a melody, just the idea of it. An upright Baldwin, silent and still in a stranger's living room. Sheet music resting on the stand, caught in the breeze of a cracked window. No blood on the keys. No fingerprints. Just a ghost in the air. I saw it that day and didn't understand why it felt like a scream. July 7, 2002. That was the day the city of Topeka learned that even in the most ordinary neighborhoods, monsters move quietly. I was a freelance reporter back then. Not some hotshot investigative journalist. Just a woman trying to make rent off courthouse calendars, local fundraisers, and the occasional house fire. That morning, I was on my way to grab a statement from a judge on a zoning dispute when the call came through. Double homicide. West McVicker Avenue. Filth. Possibly domestic. PD en route. I knew the neighborhood. Middle class, quiet, the kind of place where you hear lawnmowers before you hear sirens. By the time I arrived, yellow tape had already wrapped around the modest brick house like a warning label. Neighbors stood on porches in robes and pajamas. One woman held a Bible to her chest like it could shield her from what had happened just down the street. The victims were Michael Sisko and Karen Harkness. I didn't know them personally, but their names would become permanent fixtures in my notes, my files, my dreams. Mike was a systems analyst. Lived in town for years. Quiet divorce behind him, two kids, no drama in the public record. Karen was a schoolteacher. Widowed once. Kind, community-minded, loved to play piano in her free time. They'd been dating for over a year. Friends said they were thinking about moving in together. And now they were both dead. Shot in their bed sometime after midnight. The police wouldn't say much at first. No signs of forced entry. No theft. No defensive wounds. No screams reported by neighbors. Just silence. Just two neat gunshot wounds each. One to the head, one to the chest. Deliberate. Surgical. I watched the crime scene team wheel the gurneys out as I stood behind the tape. I should have been thinking like a reporter. Details, angles, leads. But I kept looking back at the house and thinking about the piano. Why was that detail sticking? I found out later the sheet music on the stand was Debussy. Claire de Lune. Moonlight. Something about that broke me in places I didn't know were fragile. The first whispers about a suspect didn't take long. Mike's ex-wife, Dana Chandler. According to neighbors and court records, the divorce had been volatile. Not violent necessarily, but bitter. Dana had allegedly made threatening statements in the past. One of Mike's relatives told police she used to drive by his house at night just to check if another woman was inside. Still, suspicion isn't evidence. The police didn't arrest anyone. The case went cold. And so I moved on. Or tried to. Wrote a short piece for the local paper. Spoke to Karen's colleagues at the school. Even managed a quote from one of Mike's kids. Dad was happy. I don't get it. I didn't get it either. But I never stopped thinking about it. I kept the folder in my home office even when I moved out of state for a while. It stayed on the corner of my desk. Clippings, autopsy reports, scattered notes from interviews that went nowhere. The years ticked by. Nothing. But then in 2011, 9 years after the murders, the cold case squad reopened the investigation. A new detective. New techniques. Old anger. And suddenly everything changed. I was back in Kansas by then, working with an independent media outlet covering regional crime. When news of the arrest hit my desk, I dropped my coffee mug and shattered it across my keyboard. Dana Chandler. Arrested in Duncanville, Texas. Charged with the murders of Mike Sisko and Karen Harkness. My breath caught in my throat. I didn't believe in fate, but it felt like this story was calling me back. What stood out in the arrest affidavit wasn't just the alleged motive, it was the timeline. Investigators now claim Chandler had driven through Kansas, with no clear alibi, around the exact time of the murders. They cited cell phone tower data, witness inconsistencies, and circumstantial patterns that suggested premeditation. But it was still thin. No DNA. No murder weapon. No eyewitness. Just shadows. Carefully curated shadows. As I dug into the arrest more deeply, I found myself in dark corners of online forums, court document archives, even interviewing retired officers off the record. I started noticing phrases that repeated like mantras: financial pressure, emotional volatility, obsessive behavior. People whispered about offshore accounts, emotional manipulation, and a woman who could disappear when she wanted to. Dana Chandler became a ghost wrapped in human skin. But then something even stranger happened. The case files began to reveal cracks, not in the prosecution but in the process itself. Notes missing from discovery. Witnesses improperly vetted. One key investigator had left the force under suspicious circumstances. A red tape disaster tucked under the veneer of justice. I began to wonder, was Chandler a cold-blooded killer? Or a convenient villain, crafted to close a case long past its expiration? And so I made a choice. I would cover the trial from start to finish. Not as a reporter chasing headlines, but as someone looking for the truth, wherever it led and whatever it cost. There's something about that piano still echoed. And I wasn't ready to stop listening. 9 years. That's how long the bodies lay buried while the questions refused to rest. Some stories fade with time, blurred by news cycles, overtaken by newer tragedies. But the Chandler case stayed restless. It hovered like smoke after a fire, curling into inboxes, poking through police files, clinging to memory. And for those of us who followed it, those of us who couldn't let it go, it wasn't just a cold case. It was a sleeping thing with open eyes. In early 2011, I received a tip from a former clerk in the Shawnee County Courthouse. "You might want to check the docket next week," he said. "The Chandler file's moving again." I was skeptical. People whispered about that case all the time. But a week later there it was, on record. State of Kansas versus Dana Lynn Chandler. A reactivation. And this time the language had changed. Murder in the first degree. Premeditated. 2 counts. The cold case unit had apparently found new threats. Not hard evidence. No gun, no prints, no definitive surveillance. But a pattern. A motive. A series of unanswered movements, stitched together by call logs, interviews, and time-stamped fragments that, when combined, pointed in one direction. Straight at Dana. They painted a portrait. A woman who couldn't let go. Who seethed silently while Mike moved on. Who had allegedly driven from Colorado through Kansas, arriving in Topeka with no documented purpose, no hotel stay, and no gas station receipts between key time blocks. They said her vehicle matched a witness description seen outside Karen's home. That she had opportunity. Bigger. And just enough anonymity to vanish back into the highway before sunrise. The arrest came quickly. Dana Chandler was found in Duncanville, Texas, working as a tech instructor. She didn't resist. She didn't cry. According to one officer, she calmly asked if she could turn off her laptop before they cuffed her. I remember staring at her mugshot that night. Her face was tight, almost defiant. Her eyes were sharp, not in panic but calculation. Like she was already building her defense in her mind. I didn't sleep that night. Instead, I pulled out the old crime scene notes. Replayed the interviews I'd recorded in 2002. Dug out the quote from the neighbor who had mentioned Dana's car parked a few streets down. Never followed up. Never confirmed. Just filed away. And then there was the piano. The untouched piano in Karen Harkness's living room. I called a detective I trusted who had since retired. "Tell me something weird about the scene," I asked him. He paused, then said, "No forced entry. No footprints. One window cracked, but locked from the inside. The killer knew how to move quietly. No blood trail. It felt surgical. But the piano?" He sighed. "Karen played before bed. There were fingerprints on the keys. Hers. The music was still set for Claire de Lune. Moonlight." I couldn't explain why that detail gave me chills. But it did. like a moment frozen in time before violence shattered it. The first pretrial hearings began in late 2011. Chandler pled not guilty. Her defense team argued there was no physical evidence, that she had been railroaded by desperation, by investigators under pressure to close a high-profile case before political re-election. They leaned into bureaucratic failure, misplaced records, mishandled timelines. No direct link, they repeated. Just assumptions. But the prosecution pressed harder. They showed jurors maps of Dana's travel route, texts sent to friends in which she vented about Mike's relationship, a voicemail recovered from 2001 where she told a friend, "If I can't have peace, neither can he." Circumstantial? Maybe. But emotionally charged enough to draw blood. I sat in court each day, notebook in hand, watching Dana. She rarely looked at the prosecution. She watched the jury. She watched the clock. And one time, just once, she looked directly at me. I don't know if she recognized me from our old interview, or just sensed that I was paying attention in a different way than the others. But something passed between us. Question maybe. Or a dare. That night, back at the motel I was staying in for the trial, I reviewed my recordings and found something strange. Background noise in an interview I'd done with Karen's best friend. A soft, repeating knock. I'd never noticed it before. Sounded like piano keys. Pause. I played it over and over. There was no piano in the room we'd interviewed in. I knew I was starting to slip. Obsession creeps in quietly, especially when you think you're in control of the story. But I had to follow it. I traced the timeline. I visited gas stations between Colorado and Topeka. Spoke to clerks. Reviewed logs. One woman, an overnight worker in Salina, said she remembered a nervous woman in a silver sedan buying gas and sunflower seeds at 3:17 a.m. on July 7th. She was never called to testify. No record of the purchase was in evidence. When I brought this to a contact in the DA's office, he shook his head. "We can't chase every ghost, you know. But what if this one holds the key? You think you're the only one obsessed with truth?" he snapped. "We're trying to serve justice, not make a podcast." That hit deep. But I wasn't making a podcast. I was documenting a legacy. The legacy of how the justice system clings to narratives, how it tolerates financial corruption, and how true stories sometimes get buried under bureaucracy. Justice tales are rarely clean. And as the trial date approached, I realized something terrifying. This wasn't just about Dana anymore. This was about the system. The people in it. The pressure. The wealth shielding, the secret stories no one prints. This case was pulling people into its orbit, chewing them up, spitting them out, and keeping only what served the illusion of control. One detective I spoke with off the record said something that kept me awake for nights. "Look too long into this one and you'll find yourself not caring whether she did it. You'll just want someone to bleed." I believed him, because I was starting to feel it. The first day of Dana Chandler's trial felt like a funeral. Not because there were coffins or tears. Those had already been spent years ago. But because everyone in that courtroom knew this case had already buried people, whether the verdict came in guilty or not. The gallery was packed. Reporters shoulder to shoulder. Mike Sisko's family sat in a tight row, hands clenched. Karen Harkness's children were quieter. Older now, hardened by years of loss. And Dana? She walked in like a ghost. Calm. Pale. Poised. A dark gray blazer, hair pulled back. Her expression unreadable. As if this were just a clerical formality she had to attend. But make no mistake, this wasn't bureaucracy. This was war. The prosecution came out swinging. They knew what they didn't have. No DNA, no weapon, no witnesses. So they built a story. And stories, as I'd learned in my years as a journalist, could be more dangerous than facts. They started with motive. A bitter ex-wife who felt abandoned. Jealousy. Resentment. Control. They showed email drafts Dana never sent, printed from her recovered hard drive. They read them aloud. "You think you can take my life and just hand it to her? I see everything, Mike. Don't think I don't." Chilling words. Maybe poetic. Maybe damning. But still, words. No action. No proof she'd ever even driven to Kansas that night. Then came the timeline. A digital reconstruction built from cell tower pings, road maps, and security footage. Dana's car was allegedly seen on a gas station camera. Grainy, time-stamped, unconfirmed. A witness from a nearby neighborhood swore they saw a woman matching her build walking past the Harkness residence shortly after 1 a.m., carrying something heavy and wrapped in fabric. The prosecution called it the weight of intent. I sat in the third row just behind the press box, scribbling notes and trying to breathe. I didn't want to admit what I was thinking. They were convincing. Dana's defense team hit back hard. No fingerprints, no DNA, no gun, they repeated like a mantra. All we have here is a murder narrative built on paranoia, projection, and red tape errors. They presented Dana as a woman rebuilding her life in Texas. Working, teaching, volunteering. They said the prosecution had tunnel vision, driven more by public demand than actual proof. They even implied that certain pieces of evidence, like potential sightings or receipts, had been buried because they didn't support the state's theory. They hinted at something darker. A culture of selective justice. The term shadows of justice rang in my head like a bell I couldn't unring. And then I made a mistake. I started digging on my own. Not just reporting, investigating. I reached out to Dana's old acquaintances, former co-workers, even one of her siblings. I wanted to understand who she was, what she could be capable of. And that led me to a man in Lawrence, retired, quiet, refused to be recorded. He told me something I still don't know how to process. I knew Mike. We had drinks once or twice. He wasn't afraid of her, but he never left the doors unlocked when she was back in town. Ever. I asked if he thought Dana did it. He shook his head. Doesn't matter what I think. The story's already written. All they need now is a narrator. He was right. The courtroom wasn't a place for discovery. It was a place for performance. For a chilling narrative to be recited in just the right order. The turning point came when the prosecution brought in an expert in behavioral profiling. He didn't know Dana. Never interviewed her. But based on her alleged travel route, her communication history, and her emotional residue, he called her a classic high-control obsessive with revenge ideation. I remember that term, emotional residue. It made Dana sound like a chemical spill. By the time closing arguments rolled in, I could feel the verdict in the air. Not in the facts, but in the fatigue. The jury looked tired, worn. They wanted resolution. A name. A reason. And the state had given them just enough breadcrumbs to follow into belief. The verdict came fast. Guilty on both counts. Mike's family cried. Karen's daughter stared straight ahead. Dana showed no emotion as they read the verdict. None. But I saw her knuckles tighten white against the wood of the defense table. Just for a second. I filed my report, went on air for a late night segment, and pretended to feel the same sense of finality everyone else seemed to. But that night, alone in my hotel room, I listened to an old interview I'd done with Dana a decade ago. A scratchy recording. Her voice soft but deliberate. "I didn't kill them," she said. "But people want a villain more than they want the truth. And I guess I make a good one." I paused the recording and stared at the ceiling for hours. Something didn't sit right. And then came the leak. A former court clerk sent me a flash drive. No name. No return address. Inside were emails between prosecutors and Topeka PD. Emails that included evidence never turned over to the defense. One of them mentioned a local contractor who had been seen arguing with Mike weeks before the murder. Never followed up. Never entered into evidence. I was holding a thread that could unravel the whole conviction. And I knew, pulling it would come with a price. But I'd already crossed the line. I wasn't just reporting the crime anymore. I was inside it. Truth doesn't always arrive with trumpets and confetti. Sometimes it crawls through the back door carrying a flash drive in a plain manila envelope. The morning I opened that email, subject line, "You were right to dig," I felt my hands go cold. The attachments were clear. Prosecutorial emails. PDF scans. Phone logs. And most damning of all, a notice of potential exculpatory evidence, never disclosed to the defense. A name that had been deliberately omitted from the trial. A former handyman who'd worked on Karen Harkness's house in the weeks before the murder. He had a record, nothing violent, mostly theft and property damage. But still, he'd been flagged in an early interview with police. Then, conveniently, he disappeared from the paperwork. Buried. Like the bodies. I printed every document. Highlighted. Annotated. Compared them to the official court transcripts and discovery files. The discrepancies weren't just clerical, they were strategic. Witnesses rephrased. Conflicting statements omitted. A carefully curated narrative, built with surgical precision. I didn't sleep that night, or the one after. My nightly reflections became maddening. I kept hearing Dana's voice in my head. People want a villain more than they want the truth. He was right, and the truth had teeth. I took the documents to a criminal defense attorney I trusted in Wichita. She spent 3 hours reviewing the files in silence, then looked up at me with the expression of someone staring into a crime scene no one else believed existed. If even half of this is accurate, she said, it's grounds for overturning a conviction. And not just procedural error, we're talking malicious suppression. A systemic failure. Red tape. Bureaucracy. Wealth shielding. Protecting not people, but reputations. 2 weeks later, news broke that Dana Chandler's legal team had filed an appeal with the Kansas Supreme Court. And within months, shockwaves. Her conviction was overturned. The ruling cited prosecutorial misconduct, specifically failure to disclose evidence that may have impacted the jury's decision. The same evidence I had in a manila folder tucked under my coffee-stained laptop. Suddenly, I wasn't just reporting on the system, I had become part of the case. Some praised me. Others accused me of bias. Of being too close. I received threatening messages. Anonymous calls. One night, I found the words, "Stay in your lane," scratched into the driver's side of my car. I should have walked away. But when you stare too long into a sinister case, you start to see your own reflection in the glass. I needed resolution. For myself. For Mike and Karen. Even for Dana. Especially for Dana. The backlash from the overturned conviction set the state on fire. The DA's office refused to accept responsibility. They blamed clerical errors, miscommunication, a bloated investigation lost in its own maze of reports. But for many in the justice system, it wasn't just a bureaucratic embarrassment. It was a revelation. It forced the state to publicly confront the idea that justice wasn't served. It was staged. The retrial was inevitable. But this time eyes were everywhere. Media. Advocacy groups. Civil rights attorneys. True crime fans who once devoured murder tales like popcorn were now tweeting legal documents line by line, as if justice were a form of crowdsourced entertainment. But beneath the buzz was something darker. Fear. I knew Dana's new defense team would weaponize the system's failures. They had to. And they should. That's how investigative storytelling works. You strip away the illusion, reveal the bones. Let the blood run if it must. But there was something else now. Something watching me. I started noticing strange cars near my apartment. My email was hacked twice. My editor received an unsigned letter suggesting I had tampered with sealed materials. My name was floated on a legal blog, accusing me of being in inappropriate proximity to a primary case witness. I wasn't scared for my life, but I was scared of what I'd become. The line between journalist and advocate had blurred. I had walked into the depths of crime and forgotten to leave breadcrumbs behind. And then came the call. A withheld number. A male voice. Calm. Measured. "You're very good at finding the story," he said. "But some stories want to stay hidden." I reported it. The cops shrugged. No proof, no context. Just a chilling detail for a journalist to file under, "Keep your mouth shut." But I couldn't. I was already in too deep. I had heard the screams from the basement even if no one else had. The retrial date was announced, August 2022. I would be there. Front row. Not for Dana. Not for vindication. For the truth. Because no matter what happened next, guilty or not, I had to know if the justice system I had spent my life covering still worked. Or if it was just another carefully curated illusion. A crime scene investigation buried beneath layers of legal theater, narrative manipulation, and emotional residue. I packed my bag. And I returned to the courthouse. To face Dana Chandler. They called it the second chance at justice. But by the time I walked back into the Shawnee County Courthouse in August 2022, it felt more like a second descent. This time into a version of hell I'd helped build. The air was different. Colder. Like the courtroom had learned how to hold its breath. I sat in the gallery with a recorder tucked in my bag, a legal pad in my lap, and nerves coiled so tight my fingers trembled just writing the date. Dana Chandler entered through the same door as before. Same posture. Same mask of control. But her eyes were different. not blank, sharp. Like a woman who had survived something and now understood how little it mattered. This wasn't about innocence anymore. It was about power. This time her legal team came loaded. They laid bare every flaw in the original trial. Evidence suppression, inconsistencies in the timeline, forensic ambiguity. They even questioned the cell tower data, arguing it had been misinterpreted or worse, manipulated. And for the first time, they directly named alternate suspects, including the handyman I'd uncovered. I watched the prosecutors shrink slightly under that weight. Not crumbling. Just retreating into defensiveness. Into the language of technicalities. One witness collapsed under cross-examination. Another admitted their memory might have been confused by what they'd seen on TV. A third broke down when shown photos of Karen Harkness and admitted, "I didn't want to believe she was gone. I still don't." It was heartbreaking. And exhausting. Each night I returned to my motel room drained. I'd try to write, but my words came out stilted. Impersonal. I knew too much. Felt too much. I was no longer writing a true crime story. I was writing my own unraveling secrets. One night, after reviewing audio from the courtroom, I heard something strange in the background. A faint melody, almost like someone humming. I scrubbed back. Played it again. Claire de Lune. It couldn't be real. Not again. But there it was, soft, ghostly, barely audible under the shuffle of papers and coughs. The piano in Karen Harkness's house had become a symbol in this case. An emblem of innocence, routine, and the quiet before chaos. That melody had played the night she died. And now, somehow it was following me. I began dreaming of it. Waking up gasping, heart pounding, with the image of Dana's eyes fixed on mine. Not angry. Not afraid. Knowing. Meanwhile, the pressure outside the courtroom mounted. Social media turned the retrial into a spectacle. True crime fans posted side-by-side comparisons of Dana's trial. Looks like it was fashion week for trauma. Legal YouTubers argued over the investigation narratives, trying to decode the psychology of everyone involved, including me. They found old clips. Pulled my voice from podcasts I'd long forgotten. Labeled me everything from fearless investigative hero to biased media parasite. I lost work. Lost friends. Lost track of why I started any of this in the first place. I stopped answering calls from my editor. Started drinking wine straight from the bottle. I'd watch trial footage at 2 a.m., mouthing along with Dana's statements like I was studying a script. Like I was preparing to play her. But I wasn't her. I was something worse. A journalist caught between truth and narrative. And then the jury deadlocked. The mistrial was announced just before 10 a.m. on a rain-soaked Wednesday. The court clerk looked visibly shaken reading the decision. No one clapped. No one cried. Dana didn't even blink. She turned to her attorney, whispered something, then stood quietly while the judge cleared the court. Me. I sat there long after the pews emptied, staring at the seal on the wall behind the judge's bench. To the ends of justice. Felt like a lie. Justice wasn't something you reached. It was something you negotiated. Something you performed. And somewhere along the way, it had slipped into the shadows. I packed up my files that night and drove aimlessly down I-70, ending up outside Topeka's old industrial district, rusted out factories and abandoned rail lines. And I realized something. This story wouldn't end with a verdict. Not for Dana. Not for Mike and Karen. And definitely not for me. I had started this journey trying to expose the truth. But what I found instead was a system built on chilling narratives, political pressure, and emotional theater, where truth was only useful if it fit the script. As I sat there watching the sun set over crumbling smokestacks, I made a decision. If this case wasn't going to end in justice, then I would end it in truth. Even if that meant following Dana into the next trial. Even if it meant risking everything I had left. Because when you stare long enough into hidden killers, the bureaucrats, the storytellers, the polite murderers in suits, you stop fearing the crime. You start fearing the silence around it. Justice doesn't arrive in a flash. It creeps. It hesitates. Tests your faith. And sometimes, it feels like punishment for everyone involved, no matter the verdict. The third trial of Dana Chandler began in February 2024. 22 years after Mike Sisko and Karen Harkness were murdered in their bed, the story finally returned to the same courtroom. Different paint, same ghosts. I almost didn't go. I had told myself I was done. That I'd given enough, of my time, my career, my sanity. But something wouldn't let me rest. Maybe guilt. Maybe pride. Maybe obsession. Or maybe it was the truth whispering that its story wasn't finished. When I stepped back into the courthouse, I barely recognized myself in the reflection of the glass doors. My hair was shorter. My eyes were tired. I no longer looked like a journalist chasing a headline. I looked like someone who'd been living inside a murder for 2 decades. Dana looked the same. Her eyes scanned the courtroom like she was still calculating every angle, every person, every weakness. But her body seemed looser, like she had surrendered to the chaos. Like she'd stopped expecting to control how the story ended. This time, the prosecution was merciless. They had learned from every misstep, every overturned ruling, every detail I had once uncovered and made public. They came not just for Dana's character, but for her movements, her timeline, her intent. They used technology, AI-enhanced security footage, car recognition software, travel data plotted on animated maps. It was cold, clinical, and chilling. They walked the jury through her 2002 route in real time from Colorado to Kansas, with gas receipts and timestamp tower hits. They emphasized her silence after the murders, her lack of grief, her absence from both memorials. They told a thrilling narrative, one built not on blood but on behavior. But the moment that broke the room was the playback of an old voicemail. It was her voice. From years ago. Oh, controlled. Almost gentle. You can't hide from what you did to us. You broke it. And I'm not done. Not yet. The jury was silent. Karen's daughter began to cry. Dana didn't blink. The defense fought back with fury. They emphasized the same gaps. No weapon, no eyewitness, no forensic match. They accused the state of relying on crime narratives, not evidence. They even implied law enforcement had been influenced by external media coverage, looking directly at me when they said it. I didn't flinch. They were right. I had shaped this story, pushed it back into light, demanded that someone somewhere be held accountable. And now I had to watch as that responsibility played out like a slow-motion crash. The trial lasted weeks. I sat through every day. I stopped taking notes by the second week. Not because I didn't care, but because I knew I wasn't just documenting anymore. I was grieving. For Mike. For Karen. For Dana. For myself. The jury returned after 6 hours. 6 hours to decide 2 decades of suffering. Guilty. On both counts. The courtroom didn't erupt. There was no cheering. Just air. Heavy and cold. Dana Chandler stood motionless as the words echoed through the room. Her attorney reached for her arm, but she didn't move. I could see her jaw tighten. Just barely. Her voice didn't crack. Not even when she whispered to the judge, "I never stopped loving him. I didn't write a headline that night. I didn't do a live broadcast. I went home. And I cried. Not for her. Not for them. But for the story, the carefully curated tragedy I'd lived in for too long." I walked through my apartment that night like it was a crime scene. Papers everywhere. Files. Flash drives. Scribbled notes. Old interview tapes. The evidence of my own undoing. The piano music started playing in my head again. Not real. Just memory. Claire de Lune. Always that damn song. And I thought about something Dana said to me in our first and only interview over 10 years earlier. I didn't kill them. But you'll tell the story like I did. Because that's what people believe in. Not justice. Closure. He was right. This wasn't a case that ended in resolution. It ended in exhaustion. It ended in loss. In ruined lives, broken systems, and chilling secrets no verdict could undo. And as I closed my last notebook and shut down the recorder one final time, I knew I could never truly leave this case behind. Because some crime stories don't end. They echo. They become shadows of justice. Haunting the space between truth and silence. And if you listen closely, you can still hear the piano.